May it please the court, Judge Caney, Judge Wood, Judge Sykes, my name is Daniel Hessler, and I represent Marvin Chapman. It's common ground between the parties that there was a violation of Rule 404B here. The question is whether the error that occurred was harmless or not. There are several reasons why the error was not harmless. And the first thing to keep in mind was that this was a very close case. There's a factual issue, not a factual issue, but this was a case where all the counts were factually interrelated. Fundamentally, the police said they saw Marvin Chapman carrying a bag with a large assault rifle sticking out of the end of it. According to the police, they followed him into an abandoned house, chased him into it, saw him drop that, and discovered the bag. In the bag, they found a large assault rifle and a very small amount, 10 grams of heroin, a very small handful of heroin.
So I take it, I mean, the real point of contention here is whether it was Mr. Chapman with the bag.
Yes.
And your point, especially at this stage of the game at sentencing, was that if he did have the bag, he had both the heroin and the rifle, and if he didn't have the bag, he didn't have either one of them.
Exactly.
But there we are, Powell, we have an inconsistent verdict. So the real question, obviously, on the 404B error, and of course our decision in Miller came down after the district court ruled here, so perhaps she wasn't clairvoyant, is harmlessness. And so maybe you could talk about that for a minute.
As I said, the jury seemed to have voted 2 out of 3 for the defense on the question of credibility. They found him not guilty on the gun, guilty on the drugs. It's sort of inexplicable, but Powell says legally that's okay. If we're trying to figure out what the difference is between the proof on the gun counts, which were acquitted, and the proof on the drug count, what you're left with is the 404B.
Wasn't that exactly what the government said?
That is exactly what they'd said at the time of sentencing. And that says that this was not harmless error. There have been harmless error cases, like Miller on the count that was affirmed. It was sort of unrelated, separate conduct. These were together. Mm-hmm. And so the difference seems to be in the 404B.
How are you suggesting that we treat that change in position on the part of the government?
The change position on the 404B?
Right. It argued at sentencing that the explanation for the inconsistent verdict was the 404B evidence, suggesting implicitly, if not explicitly, that the evidence made a significant difference in the jury's verdict and its position on appeal, which is that it made no difference at all.
I'm suggesting that you remand this case for a new trial.
No, I understand what you want for a remedy. Do we treat it as a waiver? Do we treat it as a question of judicial estoppel? From your perspective, it doesn't matter as long as you win. I get that part
of
it. But
I hadn't thought about it in those terms. Be candid, I don't think it was a waiver because I don't think it was knowing and intelligent. I think they were just being candid.
That's interesting.
But it was nevertheless a recognition of reality that was the difference in this case. The government has candidly recognized that after Miller, the 404B ruling in this case couldn't stand. And so what's left is this harmless error question, and it's not harmless. This was a case where the jury ruled 2 out of 3 for the defense. They don't seem to have necessarily believed the police. We have no idea why they found him guilty.
So let me ask you this. I mean, one of the things the government is now arguing is that there was a limiting instruction after the 404B evidence came in. Was that of any use in your view?
It's not, for several reasons. One, because limiting instructions are of they may be effective. Second, the 404B evidence came in two forms. One, it came in through a short and concise stipulation in the government's rebuttal case. It also came in through 9 pages of cross-examination in the cross-examination of the defendant. It was something that was run over at length, and so the impact can't be remedied simply by a limiting instruction.
Well, is there any, I mean, a limiting instruction implies that, you know, essentially the judge is saying to the jury, you can't consider this evidence for propensity, but you can consider it for intent. You know, it has to identify what the jury can consider the evidence for, and I'm actually trying to probe whether you think there was any potential legitimate use of this evidence.
I don't believe there was. As this court said in Miller, the question that needs to be asked is, if it's being admitted to prove intent, how did this particular information show intent? And in this case, it showed that Marvin Chapman, back in 2005, possessed heroin wrapped in tin foil and was trying to sell it. And how that shows intent in 2010, if it's not that he did it once, he's doing it again, I have no clue how it shows intent. So the instruction that the jury was given in this case was, you may consider this only for intent and knowledge. But I have no idea what that means.
So the limiting instruction in this case actually made the problem worse because intent wasn't the focus of the defense.
It was
an all or nothing, I didn't possess the bag defense.
Right.
So
I don't think the limiting instruction in this case helped. There might be a case where a limiting instruction is effective. This wasn't it.
So let me ask you a question about sentencing, because it seems that your theory was that because this was bore the marks, perhaps, of a compromised verdict, that somehow that ought to justify a sentence substantially below the guidelines range. But I'm not sure that there's any authority for that, number one. And number two, the district judge was quite careful to look at Mr. Chapman's full criminal record, which was a lengthy one, and she remarks at one point, you are the person that the career offender guideline was designed for. So I'm not sure how you could either say she wasn't looking at the whole thing or that she somehow made a mistake in choosing the 210-month sentence.
May I grab my copy of 3553?
You be my guest, yeah.
My authority would be 3553A, which lists the considerations for sentencing, and obviously this court knows these, and that includes the need for the sentence imposed to reflect the seriousness of the offense, to promote respect for the law, and to provide just punishment. Now, in this case, we have a mysterious, baffling jury verdict that suggests that they may not have agreed that the police were believable. One possibility is that they acquitted a guilty man of possessing a gun, although why they would have done that after hearing about his 6 prior convictions and his drug dealing and his drug use and all those things, I don't understand. And the other possibility is they convicted an innocent man of something that they didn't actually believe he did. Now, that possibility, I believe, factors into the need to promote the respect for the law and to provide just punishment for the offense. If a judge thinks there's a chance this person didn't do it, a lower sentence is appropriate, and it's supported by 3553A. That was my...
Okay. I mean, you know, if the judge really thinks that, it seems to me there are other remedies. I mean, there's sufficiency of the evidence appeals. There are other ways of getting at it. But if you're introducing a new theory, we'll consider it.
That was it. I mean, and the idea on the two arguments that were made at sentencing. One was that it had to do with the career offender guideline. Career offender typically adds you know, 2, 4, 6, 8 levels. In this case, because the numbers were so low, it added 12 to 16 levels. And that's something that's not taken into account. The guideline was correctly calculated. And the other was this odd thing in the verdict. And both of those I asked the court to consider, and I don't believe the record shows that they were.
You've got a couple of other evidentiary arguments here, one having to do with the admission of his your client's prior record for impeachment purposes.
Yes.
And some rehabilitation that you wanted to do on that, and then the other about the clash between the Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights.
Yes.
Of the witness and the defendant. Do you want to take a moment on either of those?
On the Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights, I will stand on my brief. On the 609 rehabilitation question, essentially Mr. Chapman was impeached with 6 prior convictions and was not allowed to say this time is different. Essentially, there's nothing in Rule 609 that says a defendant can't explain prior convictions. The law is fairly clear that the government can't go beyond the nature of the conviction, the date of the conviction, possibly the sentence, which they did. But we weren't allowed to go past that either. And essentially, this was creation of new law. And it was done without the judge realizing that she was creating new law. This is an error of law.
So the argument is basically that the trial court committed evidentiary error based on a misunderstanding of Rule 609, a misconstruction of Rule 609, or that there was a constitutional infirmity, or both?
Both. I'm not sure the court understood where that limitation was coming from, and I don't know whether it was coming from 609. And because of it, the defendant wasn't allowed to put on a defense, which was to say, this time is different. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if possible. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Raj Lott. I represent the government. The district court's decision to admit a single prior instance of heroin trafficking under Rule 404B was harmless in this case for 4 reasons, but the first and foremost reason is because far more evidence of the defendant's prior involvement with drugs and drug trafficking was introduced by the defendant himself on direct examination.
But he knew the judge was going to allow this 404B in, so he's fronting that. I don't see what conceivable permissible purpose there was for this 2005 conviction to come in. And it seems to me, out of the government's own mouth, we know that that's the difference between the heroin conviction and the acquittal on the gun. That he did it before, but that's, of course, completely impermissible.
Your Honor, 2 points, and they're related in response. The first is the defendant chose to introduce far more evidence than was coming in under Rule 404B. The district court decision was about one particular instance.
Well, but he didn't know what you were going to do, and, of course, you know, of course, we've got the 609 problem, which I can come to in a minute, but I'm not at all persuaded that once he's lost on the motion in limine and the judge has said, oh, this is just like my earlier decision in Miller, I'm going to let this stuff come in, and then the government harps on the earlier event for a fairly long period of time in cross-examination, it's very hard to distill out how the jury could have considered this case. And I just don't think it's possible to say that he opened the door to it and it's all his fault. He lost the motion in limine.
Your Honor, I agree. And I think what distinguishes it from simply fronting something that was going to come in otherwise is, first of all, that he went far beyond it. And second, that it was actually a theme of the defense, and it's a theme that goes, frankly, to the verdict that the jury ultimately returned. The theme of the defense was that the defendant, while certainly somebody who frequently sells drugs, was not somebody who, because of his drug addiction, was trustworthy enough to carry the sort of firearm that the police saw him with.
Well,
so,
that may be, but I, you know, the issue is whether he's the one with the bag. He's trying now, in the extent a man of this limitation can do so, to appear forthcoming and honest to the jury. He's sort of giving them the good and the bad, and he's very carefully not contesting, you know, the possession of that I've never seen heroin before or anything like that really would have allowed the government perhaps to use this evidence. I think this is just something that got off on the wrong track as soon as the judge makes the mistake on the motion in limine.
And we're certainly not contesting that it was a mistake to introduce that evidence. I will note that the government at no point made any arguments to try to suggest that the jury should draw a propensity inference, and that while the jury did come back with a split verdict, which is puzzling and I think was speculated upon at sentencing, the reality is that the evidence at trial was that four officers saw the defendant with the gun and the bag.
So the jury might have believed that, but they chose not to.
Well,
I mean, that doesn't tell me that the four officers had gold-plated reputations with the jury, because it rejects their testimony on that point.
Your Honor, the jury verdict is difficult to understand, but it does not necessarily mean that the jury rejected the officer's testimony. The government bore the burden of proof of proving this case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Of course it means the jury rejected the government's testimony. If four officers get up there and say he had a gun, and the jury says, no, he didn't have a gun, they've rejected the testimony.
Your Honor, I think this is the problem in Powell. We don't know. There are other reasons why the jury may have decided to acquit the defendant of the gun charge, and those are all within the province of the jury and are unknowable to us.
Well, and I'm accepting that we have the two things, but I just am not persuaded that we can do much with the fact that there was a conflict in the testimony about the bag. And I actually want to point out there's another problem with the 609 issue that nobody has raised, but it's of great concern to me. The standard for admitting past convictions isn't just that they come in. The rule says they come in if the probative value of the evidence outweighs its prejudicial effect, which is a higher standard of admissibility than 403. 403 says it comes in unless the probative value is substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. And the judge doesn't seem to have weighed the pros and cons of bringing in the 609 evidence. And so that's a problem even before we get to the question, where in the rule does it say he can't say I pleaded guilty? I don't see that anywhere.
Your Honor, I don't believe the rule 609 that says he can't get into it. I think it's simply relevance under 403 and then prejudice under
404. 401, you mean.
I'm sorry, 401. I apologize.
The judge never undertook that analysis, though.
Well, I think the judge did, and where I think the judge was doing that is when she talks about all of the collateral issues that would be raised if we asked whether the decision to plead guilty bears on truthfulness. After all, the evidence...
Oh, but please, every Rule 11 colloquy involves the judge saying to the defendant, are you pleading guilty because you're really guilty? And we repeatedly refuse to allow people to withdraw pleas of guilty because we say this is under oath, this is a solemn event, you know, this is a judicial admission, we rely on it for Booker purposes. I mean, this flight that the district court made into all the reasons why somebody might falsely plead guilty is crazy to me.
And Your Honor, perhaps I misunderstood what the district court was saying, but the way I interpreted it was not that the defendant would falsely plead guilty or that the plea of guilty would not be truthful, but that all of the circumstances leading to the decision to plead guilty affect how probative it is of truthfulness.
But the question under 401 is not does it open and shut the case. It's is this evidence that would tend to move the ball a little bit in the direction of the fact that he's trying to prove. He pleaded guilty, and he told the judge on all those prior occasions, undoubtedly, that he was pleading guilty because he really was guilty. He was fessing up to what he did. Now, whether he was doing so because he realized there was no way out or whether he was doing so because he was remorseful is really not important. he pleaded guilty. He acknowledged his guilt.
I agree, Your Honor, but I don't see the relevance of him contesting his guilt in this case as opposed to pleading guilty in prior cases.
He just wants to say, I pleaded guilty. And then you could have said anything you wanted to show that he was not a person of great reputation for truthfulness. I mean, I don't see why you keep the evidence out as opposed to simply deal with it, let the jury take it for what it's worth. The jury may have been very unimpressed, for all I know, but it's
an argument against the impeaching authority of the prior, the impeaching force of the prior convictions, which is perfectly relevant. And
Your Honor, the reason why I don't think it is because the impeachment that comes from the prior conviction is the fact of committing the underlying crime, not, as the defendant is suggesting the jury would conclude, falsely denying guilt in the past. So if the defendant wanted to explain why the fact that he had committed these crimes in the past did not make him an untruthful person, that would be different. But what he's trying to say here is that the manner of, essentially, that the jury would draw some inference that the manner of conviction in those prior cases was a trial, and from that speculate that the defendant is also falsely denying his guilt here. And that's such a chain of inferences that isn't supported by anything that was presented to the jury.
But the district court seemed to perceive that there was some categorical prohibition against this line of inquiry or this line of rehabilitation, and that it emanated from Rule 609. And that's just wrong.
Your Honor,
Do you disagree that that's wrong?
I don't believe that 609 contains a prohibition. 609 doesn't speak either way to the scope of further testimony from the defendant explaining those convictions. There are certainly several cases that suggest when a defendant wants to explain the conduct underlying those convictions, the district court can give him leeway to get into that. There's no case stating that 609 allows the defendant to get into the manner of conviction, and it's not relevant to the theory under which the impeachment evidence is coming in.
Why does there need to be something in Rule 609 that allows this in order for it to be relevant?
It doesn't need to be in Rule 609. It needs to be somewhere in the rules of evidence.
And in the rules of evidence, 401, the district court has broad discretion to let anything in that would tend to help the jury understand the case. This does have an effect on these prior convictions as impeachment evidence. It doesn't have to be the be-all and the end-all. You're suggesting a real restriction on district court discretion.
Your Honor, we're defending the district court's decision as an exercise of discretion.
No, it wasn't. She said it just can't come in, ever. And that's what you're arguing. You're saying the only thing that's relevant is, you know, let's say it was a heroin conviction, that the heroin conviction, not the fact that he pleaded guilty. And yet it seems to me a plea of guilty is an acknowledgement that somebody's done something wrong.
I agree that it is, Your Honor, but I don't see how that's relevant to the jury's evaluation of the credibility of the defendant, and that's why we believe it was both irrelevant, or to the extent it had some minimal relevance, would have been excludable by the district court because it would have raised a whole host of issues as to why else or what additional motivation there could have been for the defendant to plead guilty. And if the government were to get into that to attempt to rebut the defense argument, which is essentially...
The judge can shut that off if she wants. You just say, you can say you pleaded guilty, but we're going to have to leave it at that. As Judge Sykes pointed out, there's never an analysis of the comparative probative value and whether it outweighs the prejudicial effect. There's never a 401 analysis. It just stays out. Now, it may not matter if the 404B error is enough to reverse this case on. Whoever gets the case again will have to deal with it. But
Your Honor, I just want to reiterate that I believe what the district court was doing there was exercising her discretion to keep it out because she thought it would get before the jury issues that were not relevant and would be distracting, and she does discuss what those issues were. So that's why the government is defending it as an exercise of the district court's discretion, which is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. If I may also just briefly address the sentencing issue. I think the court has already covered it, but the district court did weigh and reject the defendant's sentencing argument. So for these reasons, the government asks that this court affirm the conviction and sentence of the defendant. Thank you.
Very briefly, there's things I could respond to. There are places in the transcript on the cross-examination that do sort of tie together the previous case, the 2005 case and the 2010 case. There's questions like they're asking about the 2005 case, and now they finish by saying, now you ran from the police on March 8th too, didn't you? It's propensity. It's you did it before, you're doing it now. I offer myself for any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This will be taken under advisement.